Hello and welcome to The Trust Show. I'm Lottie Edwards, and today I'm joined by Tufton's Nikos Petrakakos. Tufton Assets, ticker SHIP, operates a portfolio of second-hand commercial vessels which generate predictable, inflation-protected cash flows through fixed-rate charters. Nikos leads Tufton's London Maritime Investment Team and in April stepped into the role of co-portfolio manager. Nikos, great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So SHIP is a unique vehicle among UK investment companies. Could you bring the portfolio to life for us? How big is the fleet? What sort of things does it carry?
Yeah, and being unique is an understatement. It's the only investment trust dedicated to shipping by investing in commercially trading ocean-going ships. We have a fleet of 21 vessels, diversified fleet, and the structure and target is basically to provide regular cash flow and also dividends and returns. The fleet is made up at the moment of dry bulk carriers and product tankers. Dry bulk carry, as the name implies, anything around dry commodities such as cement, grains, coal, iron ore, etc. Whereas product tankers carry oil products, petrol, diesel, etc., and some other chemicals. And then we have two chemical tankers that carry, as the name implies, all sorts of types of chemicals. These vessels tend to be smaller and able to trade globally. We focus specifically on secondhand vessels so that they can generate cash flow already from day one when we acquire them. We already know how they perform. They tend to be high spec, fuel efficient assets that we go after. And we typically trade them with counterparties. We lease them out to them, essentially charterers, for call it about a year, typically, maybe 2 years sometimes, both on fixed rates and in some cases on so-called index rate charters. It's important to also note about shipping. I'm not sure how many of the listeners understand too much about it, but basically more than 90% of anything we touch, we consume, has been on a ship at some point in its lifetime, whether as a finished good or as a raw material or energy, like what we carry in the current fleet. So it's a pretty ubiquitous market, even though most people tend to not know much about it. And the market has a lot to do with, it's linked to the supply of ships on the one hand, the demand of cargo on the other hand, but also on the distance needed to carry that cargo. When the world is normal, it's pretty easy to predict where things are moving just based on what kind of ships you expect to be delivered from the shipyards in Asia, etc. But given the instability we have over the last, sort of since COVID, I would say, if not earlier, that instability creates inefficiencies in trade, which typically result in longer distances, and that tends to be beneficial for shipping.
So let's go further into that. There's been a lot of disruption to global trade routes over the past year and more, particularly around the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. Could you just give us an overview of where the key choke points are today and areas your ships are still avoiding?
Yeah, I would add Panama Canal to that. Mm-hmm. And that's more of a recent one, which is resurfacing from a few years back. Red Sea has been going on for a while, essentially since Gaza. The Houthis decided to threaten attacks there. They did some successful attacks, and that has obviously dissuaded a lot of transit through the Red Sea and in turn the Suez Canal. Even though sort of before what happened with Iran, that had slowed down and the Houthis had come to an agreement with President Trump, there wasn't really a return to transits through the Red Sea, because everyone was waiting to see, is this sustainable? Is this going to actually last? Then in comes the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf, with the attacks on Iran. I think we're in a similar position. Even though there was that temporary ceasefire, almost all transits were outbound. We see very little bit going back in. And then now you have Panama Canal, which is completely unrelated to geopolitics, and that's related to the El Nino effect, where causing droughts in the Panama Canal, which ends up limiting the number of transits significantly. The key point is actually some of these end up working in tandem. So because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, you have to source the cargo elsewhere. Most of that has come out of the U.S. because of the drawdown on oil inventories. But a lot of that ended up, normally would transit still through the Suez Canal to go to Asia. Most of the exports were to Asia. Now, because of the Suez Canal's closure, they have to go through either the Panama Canal or through the south of through Horn of Africa. With the Panama Canal droughts, transit costs have gone up significantly. Transit times have doubled through the Panama Canal, where it's almost more efficient to still go through throughout around Africa, essentially, which adds 2 weeks to a trip. You know, instead of 30 days, it's 45 days, give or take, depending on the speed of the ship. So all of that has a compounding effect, essentially. And, you know, as you see with the Panama Canal, it's really not just geopolitics. Some of it is just driven to accidents, the Ever Given. I don't know if you remember that, basically shutting down the Suez Canal during COVID, or increasing, you know, climate impacts that cause dislocations of cargoes around the world and where you end up getting it.
Mm-hmm. And looking specifically at the Strait of Hormuz, there were reports of progressive conversations between Oman and Iran last week. Do you see light at the end of the tunnel? How long do you think disruption will last?
I think we still remain somewhat cautiously optimistic that some resolution will be had. I think both sides need some resolution. I would suspect by both sides, I mean U.S. and Iran. But even if there is a resolution, I think we're not going back to the status quo. And typically, the longer this lasts, the more permanent the shift in trade routes will be. You're already seeing it. Saudi Arabia is now exporting through the Red Sea, north of where the Houthis are. You see UAE announcing that they're trying to build pipelines and ports outside mm-hmm. of the Strait of Hormuz. But the big thing is, you saw that also with the Trump tariffs, such as Apple, for example, going to diversify their production sources outside of China and moving mm-hmm. to India. You're going to see that elsewhere, right? So many Asian countries got significantly impacted by suddenly so much of that cargo being shut in that they're looking for other sources. Even if the Hormuz situation gets resolved, they're not suddenly going to bounce right back and get everything from the Gulf again. They will try to have some diversification on purpose to protect themselves from future shocks. Because Iran shutting down the Hormuz was seen as a bit of a taboo, and that taboo has now been broken.
And I thought it was interesting you said to me before that in terms of energy price volatility, we're lucky that this disruption happened in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, if it had happened peak winter, let's call it a few months before it happened, we would have probably run out of stocks earlier, despite drawdowns in the reserves and inventories. Then you had China also quickly trying to curtail their demand. Their demand. You have a lot of Asian countries that have shifted to using coal instead of gas for their energy, which has helped our dry bulk carriers. But you know, all of that, obviously the demand was different. Now that may change going forward with the El Nino effect. The heat, as we're seeing here, although I don't know if that's necessarily directly related to El Nino, results in droughts, results in a lot more heat that requires more energy for air conditioning, etc. Then, you know, depending on how the winter goes, I think we have to see how all of that ends up being impacting the market.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned that Tufton's been able to profit from geopolitical volatility, but could you kind of break down exactly what you profited from? I know shares in the trust are up 20%, over 20% year to date. Kind of why is that?
It's a dual impact. So when typically geopolitical event happens, you have a spike. I mean, I'll use the example of the Hormuz. So you had suddenly you had about 20% of the cargo shut in, but at the same time you also had, I think it was more than 15% of tankers trapped inside the Gulf. That obviously creates a dislocation there. And as the cargoes then had to shift from the US exports, that's, as I mentioned earlier, a lot longer distances. So you need a lot more ships for the same amount of cargo. So that ended up within a week spiking rates from, call it 20-something thousand per day to more or less all-time highs. On crude tankers, which we don't have in our fleet, they reached all-time highs from under $100,000 a day to more than $700,000 a day in certain cases. So it was that immediate spike in rates. Then because that ended up lasting, obviously it did come back down a little bit, still well above where it was before the war. But the longer those rates last, the more impact it has on the long-term rates as well, which then impacts asset values. So for ship specifically, we've had that dual impact from the tankers, both in rates and in asset values. Mm-hmm. On, I'll use one example. I mean, we had one ship because of that ended up being rechartered for almost 50% higher than it was in its previous time charter. Then on the dry bulk side, it's different impact. So there, I mentioned the gas to coal switch on energy use. That has had a positive impact for dry bulk. Now El Nino and the drought, that is impacting sort of Panama Canal, that is impacting dry bulk significantly. It's also quite a bit up before the war. We bought two ships, dry bulk carriers, back in April. They have already gone up more than 10% in value. And the time charters that we had secured on one vessel was on index base. It's already earning more than $2,000 per day versus the other vessel that was on the fixed charter. Mm-hmm. And because of El Nino, et cetera, we think that it's a long-term impact. Like I mentioned before, it's not just a spike because of what's going on and the resolution happens and suddenly everything's back to normal. Mm-hmm. So we see this as a longer-term play. The other point is more going to the supply of vessel side. So there, to build a ship takes 12 to 18 months. Currently, shipyards are full, and it takes more than 3 years to deliver a ship. So we have a good visibility of where the supply is coming, how long it's taking, and the fleet is aging. So right now you have, typically they last about 25 years. Mm-hmm. The fleet over 20 years old is bigger than the current order book of ships expected over the next few years. Mm-hmm. And because of the shipyards being full, we know not to expect too much more. The other point is on the shipyard order book is most of those have been large container ships, large tankers, large gas carriers. So for the fleets we typically have, they tend to be lower margin for the shipyards. So they prefer not to build those. Mm-hmm. So the supply-demand story there tends to be quite positive for our ships. I don't think there's enough ships being built to replenish the aging fleet. Mm-hmm. So throw into that then all the inefficiencies because of geopolitics and climate change, etc. We're pretty confident that this is a more of a long-term structural market benefit. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of actually locking in the higher rates, you mentioned you've done that with some ships already, but do you have as much of your fleet coming up for renewal?
Yeah, we have, I think it's about 11 ships coming up for renewal over the next few months. The majority of it is between October and end of December. We are already seeing the market stronger now. We've started some of the negotiations on or exploring the market for what to do on the first ones coming up. And already the market is stronger than where they were before. On some of them, it's not necessarily renewal. On some of them, it's just the charters have a purchase, or sorry, an extension option. And that extension option is higher than the previous rate. So it depends on whether they have that option or not. We may see a bigger jump in rates depending on which vessel. But it tends to be a mix. We have some ships with these options, but most ships didn't have an option. So we're at the moment looking pretty positive on some of the jump. Will it be similar to the one I mentioned, almost 50% up? Hopefully, but we'll have to see.
We focused on the positives for now, but surely there's some kind of negative effect from your ships traversing riskier waters, things like higher insurance premiums and more security needed. How much of the burden of those kind of things lies with the ship owner?
So first of all, I would say we're lucky that we didn't have any vessel inside the Gulf when this happened. And immediately when it happened, we instructed all our crews, all our charters to not trade in the areas. But in terms of if you are transiting any risky areas, et cetera, which likely we're not, typically anything that has to do with where you're trading and the cargo you're trading is something that our customers pay for. So we're pretty covered on that front. It hasn't really changed anything on our operating down, on our bottom line or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned how the Panama Canal specifically is being affected by drought, but how do you expect climate change? I mean, what does climate change mean for the future of shipping more generally?
So shipping is the most fuel efficient or energy efficient mode of transport. That being said, it is a hard to abate industry, similar to aviation, for example, because even if you try to slap a battery onto a ship, it's going to be bigger than the ship itself. So we have to rely on alternative fuels, whether that's ammonia, methanol, hydrogen, LNG, biofuels, etc. I think those will take time. Last October, the International Maritime Organization, which is part of the UN, and it's basically what dictates regulations globally, given how global of an industry it is, postponed their greenhouse gas related regulations under pressure from the US and Saudi Arabia. It was postponed by a year. We think it will probably keep being postponed as long as Trump is in office, if not longer. But that being said, the train has left the station. I don't think it's going back. I think this decarbonization will happen, just probably slightly slower than we were hoping for. You know, we want some clarity. Mm-hmm. But what that results in is, for longer period, fuel-efficient vessels like the ones we have are higher in demand. The older vessels that are less fuel-efficient, they will have to end up slowing down, which ends up impacting their tradability. We have spent more than $500,000 per vessel upgrading them for fuel efficiency with various technologies. We've tested high-end technologies such as wind propulsion, literally spinning cylinders that create the same effect as a sail. Mm-hmm. And we continue to test different things. But we see for the time being that decarbonization will take a little longer. So we're pretty happy with having sort of these high-spec, fuel-efficient vessels in the fleet.
Mm-hmm. Because I know was the plan originally for the company to, by 2030, to think about winding down because of tighter regulation coming in?
Yeah, and I mean, even with tighter regulation, it probably still would have taken a while, but it would have probably started to kick off a process of starting to replace fleets and ordering these dual fuel vessels. And we don't see that happening just yet. So obviously that changes that time frame. And we'll have to, you know, we keep monitoring how that's going, and together with the geopolitics and other related impacts, how that impacts our view. But for now, you know, we're pretty positive that the story is still as strong as in the previous continuation vote in 2024, and if not even stronger at this point.
Yeah. And maybe last question. We learned in May that the mandate for CQS Natural Resources was moving over to Tufton. Why is Tufton a good fit for taking on a commodities trust?
I mean, first of all, I would say it's a pretty tangential industry. It's basically dealing with what we already carry on our ships. So we felt that was a nice synergy. The team is joining in September, and we're taking over the management of that fund also a little bit later in September. But we see some good synergies that can flow both ways. For example, for the shipping investment team, they can bounce ideas off and learn sort of where things are moving on the commodity cycle, and vice versa. The sort of Keith and Rob can learn a bit from the shipping and how that impacts their potential investments on their end. So we think it's pretty synergistic, and we're looking to grow that side of the business now.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of exciting things coming from Tufton. We'll have to end there, but thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.